Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been taking your questions to the experts in a regular series of coronavirus conversations. These conversations are in collaboration with the studio at Harvard's Chan School. The whole series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. This week, I spoke with Michael Van Rooyen about a topic that isn't directly about coronavirus, but very important and very much on all of our minds right now. He is director of Harvard's Humanitarian Initiative and chairman of emergency medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And we talked about the humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Ukraine. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to start with just some big overviews that can be hard to process for myself, for sure. The war in Ukraine's forced 10 million people from their homes, and nearly 4 million have fled the country. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has recorded almost 1,200 civilian deaths and more than 1,800 injuries. And I mean, the true numbers are probably so much higher than that. Even with peace talks underway and Russia's promise to reduce military activity around Kyiv and northern Ukraine, many people are cut off from basic necessities like food, water, electricity. And last week, the US described Russian actions in Ukraine as war crimes. So to start, from your perspective, what are the biggest humanitarian threats on the ground in Ukraine right now?
Hi, Alana. And once again, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. So the biggest humanitarian threats in conflicted areas are direct injuries from combat, of course. And so Russia has had, a pretty significant history of indiscriminate bombing, particularly in apartment buildings, schools, and civilian installations, which means civilian casualties. So I think, problem number one are probably going to be civilian casualties and civilian injuries. Next to that will be the complications of disruption of healthcare services and displacement. So with a quarter of the population displaced and a large number moving across borders, the act of displacement and being a refugee or what we call an internally displaced person creates significant vulnerabilities, particularly in people who are vulnerable, like elderly, kids, pregnant women, and those people that are on the move emergently and having to cross borders or cross territories.
What about for the hospitals and healthcare clinics themselves? I mean, the WHO has been documenting this as best that they can. Something like more than 70 facilities and vehicles have been targeted.
Yes, and just as you said, the WHO has documented, I think, 72 direct attacks on civilian medical facilities, which is a violation of international humanitarian law, first of all. And secondly, it's a dangerous trend in the conduct of war in recent times. What that does is not only kill patients, but kill or restrict healthcare workers from doing their job and very much restricting the access to normal basic healthcare, not just surgical services for injuries, but actually probably even more importantly, care for chronic illnesses that people have all the time, strokes and heart attacks and hypertension and diabetes and all of those things that healthcare facilities need to care for in populations.
What changes in those environments, and are there things that make it possible that you are learning about or observing that make it possible to continue providing that important care?
I actually have always admired local healthcare providers that stay, because they do actually. Many of them, they go underground. They, create makeshift facilities to help serve the population. They sometimes move with populations to serve them. So I've always had great admiration for the local healthcare workers and professionals that actually stay despite lack of resources, supplies, or even direct attacks. I think they can be augmented by international relief organizations that can get in, but that's always complicated because access is always an issue.
Well, that leads to my next question about access. Can places like those that aren't necessarily in the direct line of fire right now, are they able to get equipment and supplies? And what is that access? What do those corridors look like?
So I think there are areas in Ukraine that can get access. They're secured and there are obstructions to access. In those directly conflicted areas, of course, when there's active bombardment, it just prohibits any activity or almost all activity. And then in areas in Ukraine that require additional support, that support is best probably coming through Poland or, you know, bigger border areas that can actually help increase their supply.
When it comes to the people who are internally displaced or in terms of the influx of refugees in these neighboring countries, you mentioned that people's direct health needs may be compromised or challenged, for example, with heart care and other things. What kind of care do many of these people need? And how are places across the borders addressing this? Or what are they needing to do?
So from the healthcare perspective, I would say they need kind of everything. And the ability of local and regional healthcare facilities, largely in Poland, but also in Romania or Moldova, to get this large influx of potential patients means that they have to scale, and they have to scale up in terms of medical supplies and providers as well, which you know, adds to a considerable burden. I think refugees need not only healthcare availability, but they need very basic things like, you know, just food, right? And especially cash. They need to be able to, they've lost everything. And so the ability to have cash to be able to participate in, or access food wherever they are is really important. And, you know, a strange thing that we don't think about, but they need internet, because without connectivity, people really, and, you know, the audience can probably believe this, they, not only is your information on your phone and your contacts, but actually your access to your safety nets, financing and banking, and all of it is on their phone. So if having access to all of that is really important.
I want to just note, we've got a lot of questions that have come in about how people around the world can support people directly affected. So I will get to that, but I have a few more things I wanted to ask. Just moving a little bit away from direct needs, as someone who here at The World has been covering a lot of the pandemic the past 2 years, thinking a lot about coronavirus, infectious diseases. I know that in Ukraine, for example, there's some higher rates of TB. And I wonder how this all impacts infectious diseases. And historically, there can be a kind of assumption about refugees and disease and myths around that. And so what are you finding is some of the risks around this and the actual situation and where that might be directed?
Yeah, that's it. You've brought up a really great point, because there is a bit of a misconception or myth around infectious diseases for refugees, certainly in other contexts where you have populations that are terribly malnourished and under vaccinated and suffer from large rates of infectious disease. It is a major and important threat. In this population, it's different. There are populations that have TB, for example. There are populations that can be subject to exposure for COVID and other infectious threats. And they're important contributors, but they're not, in my opinion, nearly as important as actually the undermining of basic medical services for what we call non-communicable diseases. So conditions that, you know, Ukrainians suffer from all the time, like those that I've mentioned. So I think it's really important to you know, demystify that a little bit and say that, yes, infectious threats, especially when populations are moving together or crammed together, can be an issue, but they're not nearly as the dominant threat compared to older people who don't have access to medications, for example, or diabetes medications. That ends up being really important. Mm.
Your group, the Humanitarian Initiative, has done work around the world, Syria, Yemen, you recently, or most recently in Iraq directly. How has this situation in Ukraine been different than other places affected by war?
There's a couple of unique features of this conflict in particular. First of all, it's the rapidity of movement. So people are displaced very quickly. Large number of people are displaced very quickly. So out of the, you know, quarter of the population and large swaths of the eastern population are on the move. You know, huge numbers of cross borders very quickly as well. So that rapid migration creates local and kind of border strain in a way that is a bit unusual. And another factor of this is that this population is very different than populations who suffer around the world in Syria or Yemen or Tigray or Horn of Africa because of their baseline health they have and the sort of social safety net that they probably have. We'll probably talk about it later, but I think it's just incredibly important to recognize the vulnerability of those other populations that we serve all year round, all the time, and the importance of really looking at Syrian refugees or those facing conflict in Tigray, Yemen, et cetera, because they are in dire need as well. But as it relates to Ukraine, I think that there are many factors that this is, a healthier population largely, and also with a greater social safety net, but large number on the move.
Has the humanitarian and international response, how does that compare?
It compares in an unusual way. I mean, I think that there's a vigorous international response, and there's a lot of complicated reasons for why, 2.5 billion and more have been donated already to trying to mitigate the effects of the Ukrainian refugee crisis and the conflict. It is not to say that that is not important. I think it is really important that we respond and respond generously in Ukraine. I think it does highlight, as I mentioned before, the need to actually recognize the vulnerabilities of many, many people around the world. There are many complicated reasons why, both from identity and proximity, people will identify with the Ukrainian crisis. They know people directly, et cetera. But part of my job would be to say, let's not forget those other crises too.
Absolutely. There are so many questions. I kind of want to pause and get to some of the ones from our viewers here. So I want to actually just go to this question from Lisa. I know you mentioned that it's really important to be thinking about crises around the world, ones that have been also going on. Needs are great. What are ways that people can help? Lisa wanted to know about what initiatives the general public can help with, particularly around Ukraine and the humanitarian response.
Thank you. It's probably the number one question that I've gotten over the past weeks as well. And first of all, thank you, because the tendency to give and to give generously is really an important feature of our culture. And I think it's a critical sentiment, actually. The challenge is to do it in the right way. So most of the time, the needs of these refugees are focusing around what they need most, which strangely are going to be things like cash and food distribution for just-in-time feeding, and eventually repatriation, and then healthcare. But most of the time, donations, and this is a common question, can I donate? And donating supplies, even medical supplies, is almost never a good idea. It seems like it would be. It seems like it's a good idea to pack stuff up and to send it. And even medical supplies, it seems like it's a good idea to pack it up. But it comes at significant expense on this side, logistical complications getting it there, and having been on the receiving side of dozens of times where there has been donations, they rarely are the right kind at the right place at the right time for the right population. And so it's far more efficient, probably a little less gratifying, but far more efficient to actually give money.
What about physicians, for example, in the U.S. providing services to displaced Ukrainians? What about telemedicine? I've heard some really powerful stories of physicians within Ukraine trying to do this as they're displaced. But what about that?
Yeah, and so again, I think this says it's most of the efforts for Western healthcare providers going to Ukraine or in bordering countries. There are some targeted needs if people are directly linked to, say, a Polish healthcare facility that can support these. But I wouldn't say large number of physicians are needed. It turns out that there are, really terrific Ukrainian and Polish physicians and physicians all along the border. So I would say that there are some targeted needs, and it can be appropriate if they are well connected. I would also say that things like telemedical support can be quite useful. There's an interesting telemedical support out of MGH that is to support critical care in some facilities. So that can be, if it is well connected and well targeted, I think can be useful. But oftentimes, because of language barriers, because of logistics and a variety of other things, they can not be as useful.
We have a few questions coming in on humanitarian relief. One from Randolph is about Are there significant coordination efforts among the NGOs, non-government organizations operating in Ukraine and bordering countries? Like, how does that ecosystem look?
Yeah, no, thank you. That's one of my main jobs, actually, at HHI, is to work on these issues. Humanitarian coordination generally is really improved over the past couple of decades. There are a number of structures that encourage and map humanitarian coordination, really focused around the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, which is a UN agency. OCHA will set up a structure within Geneva, New York, but also in central or nationally, where there is what they call a humanitarian coordinator. Those institute a number of coordination mechanisms so that healthcare organizations that work together can work together looking at health, and food and food aid can look at, they can work together. So there's a number of mechanisms used through the UN office to help coordinate non-government organization, NGO, and UN activity. So it actually seems chaotic, but it's actually a fairly well-developed system.
And you're seeing that in Ukraine and the surrounding areas right now.
Yes, because of the conflict in eastern Ukraine, there was already existing UN structures for looking at humanitarian activity in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk area, and the Donbas region. And so those have been, I think, sort of scaled, I suppose, to improve and to manage some degree of humanitarian coordination. Yes.
This question from Zoe is about the aid workers themselves. How can they operate safely in an environment with clear disregard for international humanitarian law, civilian aid and immunity? I mean, we're hearing about attacks directly and on the passageways.
Right. So there's, I think, a few examples. If they're non-conflicted areas in Ukraine, they can gain access through the government of Ukraine and be allowed potential safe practice or safe passage. And we'll have to sort of contend with equipment and supply difficulties and supply chain issues. In active areas of active bombardment, it's difficult for anybody to access or work in those areas at all, and particularly dangerous to try to cross sort of border areas or areas that are contested. And then finally, in Russian-held areas, there are reports of Russian military allowing humanitarian aid through to a certain area, but there's significant restrictions in access.
Hmm. This question is from Elaine about mental health. We've had a few questions coming in. How are organizations addressing the mental health issues of military and the millions of displaced civilians? I wonder where that fits, because it's both an immediate crisis, but obviously food and direct physical safety and security has to be the most immediate thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion and has been for many years in the mental health community, because obviously the impact of war is a massive mental health issue and creates a, exacerbates existing and creates new mental health challenges. The debate is, do you provide mental health services real time while providing other forms of relief, or you wait until there's a moment where you can manage it longitudinally and take care of patients for a longer period of time? I think that there's a lot of interest in providing acute services, but at the same time, as you say, there's a lot of, dominant needs such as water, food, cash, safety, housing, medical care.
Vaishnavi had a follow-up question to that, which is, what should we, I'm assuming humanitarian groups, but more broadly, be preparing for in terms of the challenges of specifically Ukrainian young adults, youths, from an emotional and mental health standpoint? I mean, one thing that's really striking to me is just how many children have been displaced.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think that the best thing that can happen is a ceasefire. And the best thing that can happen is some resolution so that there's not active conflict. The next thing after that is repatriation as soon as possible, because there's nothing like going back home. And so I think that would be the most helpful for both the reconstruction and safety of everybody, but also mental health issues. And then finally, there'll be sort of longitudinal needs, as we know. And we've seen really, devastating effects, emotional and mental health effects in conflicted areas in many, many conflicts around the world. But those play out over years too.
Just staying on what you mentioned about a ceasefire, if that's achieved, what would be the kind of steps that would need to happen to rebuild healthcare in Ukraine and make it stronger in the future because of what's been challenged right now?
Yeah, so I mean, a few things. I think the faster that you can get healthcare professionals back to their facilities in normal life, as it were, the less disruptive healthcare systems will be. Certainly, repairing and fixing hospitals and healthcare facilities, and then serving the public as well with a disrupted system. There's a lot of, destroyed infrastructure, water facilities that are directly targeted, electrical grids, et cetera. They all contribute to a community's ability to get access to healthcare eventually. Mm-hmm. So I think just normalcy is probably the first thing in reestablishing healthcare services.
Hmm. This is going back to the humanitarian response. It's a question from Alex, which is that there seemed to be several months leading up to this invasion. Did that impact the humanitarian response and assistance?
Kind of. I mean, one thing to remember is these are the problems here are not humanitarian in nature. They are political in nature and militarily. So I think the solution is, that we're in the aid world, we think about this all the time. The solution is not aid necessarily, right? The solution is a ceasefire and a political solution, and that humanitarian assistance is because that has failed and exists because it's failed. So aid providers were preparing and like, the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative was working in Eastern Ukraine for some time to look at ways to help that population and looking at a variety of ways to assist that conflicted population in the East. Certainly many organizations were preparing, but they could only prepare so much because we didn't know what was going to happen.
This question is from Stacy, which gets to something I've been wondering about a lot. What are the potential shadow epidemics that could have longer lasting impact on Ukraine's most vulnerable population? For example, children. I feel like each of these children is an answer in itself, women, people who are older, people with disabilities.
Yeah, so we refer to a shadow epidemic being something like, say, sexual violence or gender-based violence or things like that as well. And I think we've already seen, anytime there's a disruption of the population, you see disruption of the social fabric, and that disruption leads to potential either lack of services or even exploitation of women and children, trafficking, gender-based violence and abuse, and a variety of things like that. So I think that fortunately, in the humanitarian aid world, the issue around gender-based violence and vulnerability is built into our lexicon. We think about it all the time. We seek to find those populations and serve them. But it is a significant threat whenever there's such massive social disruption.
I mean, I have seen reports that there's been a rise in potential trafficking and exploitation. And are there specific ways or efforts to address that?
Yeah, I mean, whenever there's such a disrupted environment, rapid movement of large movement of refugees, people that are vulnerable to being sort of moved away and someplace else, vulnerable population are just looking for someplace to land. There are traffickers and people that'll exploit that. So the best thing that we can do is just, again, accomplish a ceasefire, stabilization, repatriation, and then implement all of the protection mechanisms that we have. And we saw it in the earthquake in Haiti. We saw it in many different circumstances that this happens. And it just needs to be, anticipated, recognized, combated.
This is a follow-up question from Ellen. You kind of just answered it, but it's specific to women and girls, which is what can be done to support survivors in particular and their unmet health needs.
Again, part of the aid world and the modern aid, especially with large scale humanitarian organizations in the UN and major NGOs, is actually looking exactly at this, really finding those vulnerable populations, directly serving vulnerable populations that we have. These are known to us. I mean, they're known in theory, that is. And so what's really important in aid programming and really does happen is that not only do we look to sort of stabilize populations, but really identify and focus on the needs of the kind of hyper vulnerable populations, elderly patients who can't move, children, people that are prone to being abducted or trafficked or things like that. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in what we call protection.
Hmm. This question's from Jari Mick from Estonia. And he wanted to know how neighboring countries can best manage the migration load from Ukraine. And there's another question here from Maurice about NGOs and what kind of services and supports they're offering to countries that are now taking on refugees that are fleeing.
Yeah, and the response to refugees has been, by the EU in particular, has been, you know, brisk and extremely positive. Actually, again, probably even more so than we saw with any other crisis. And so the which I think is important and really positive. So the EU opening up availability to participate in EU benefits, including potential jobs, et cetera. I think welcoming refugees and finding ways to integrate them is actually incredibly important. And there are a number of countries that do this from a national perspective. In the United States, for example, I think President Biden said they would host up to 100,000 refugees. And those are all go through kind of a national system of identification. Also, there are really excellent organizations like the International Rescue Committee. IRC is not only a relief organization, but they also do a lot with displaced populations and in resettlement. So they would be of significant assistance in populations like that.
There's actually two questions here that have come in about refugees in particular, for example, in the United States. So I just thought I'd ask them head on. One is, how might Americans seek to host Ukrainian refugees? And are there opportunities for adopting orphans?
So in reverse, orphan adoption is really tricky. And really, you know, while it's well-intentioned, it's also like fits with trafficking if you're not careful. So orphan adoption is a very tricky, difficult business and probably is not a priority at this moment. It would be needs to go through very regulated, very strict channels. The other question I think is hosting in the United States. There are organizations, and again, say International Rescue Committee, for example, identifies host families and identifies host organizations. They have offices around the United States that host refugee families. And usually those are after a period of processing time. In other words, identification of refugee status, the formalities of becoming a refugee, and then eventually things like placement or being able to bring refugees in. I would say though that I would really hope that we can gain resolution to this conflict politically to actually minimize the number of people that are going to have to move and stay as refugee status, rather, you know, move back as soon mm-hmm. as possible.
Yeah. This gets to something that you've mentioned, but it's from Maria Luisa, which is that why are Ukrainian refugees more important to Europe and the US than, say, Syrians and Afghans, Rohingyas, and many from the African continent?
That's a multi-million dollar question, right? I mean, I think that I am not in any way discounting the needs of those refugees from Ukraine that come and what their suffering is, but we are facing some of the largest humanitarian emergencies in the Horn of Africa, in Yemen, in Tigray, in the Sahel, all around the world, Syria, for example, too. And I think the reception of refugees in this case is very different than the reception of refugees from, say, Syria. And it will, I think, should require us to have a hard look at the way we, from a national perspective, perceive the friendliness or the accessibility or our openness to receiving refugees. Because frankly, there is a huge difference, and it's based on, you know, national identity and race and, public perception and nationalism. It's a complicated business. So I would I'd say that it's a complicated problem, and it's a really salient point.
Mm. I want to get back to more on the ground Ukrainian questions. I hope it's okay to run a little bit over. Awkward transition, but I'm really curious about this. Here's from Frank. Are there contingency plans for possible use by Russia of chemical or tactical nuclear weapons?
So I think that's been on the mind of a lot of people. I think that while that is a possibility, and certainly Russia's support of Syria and Syria's use of chemical weapons was really frightening, I think that there is discussion about it. I would actually say, though, that the major threats are not that. The major threats are the indiscriminate use of bombing in public areas and in cities, which has a tremendous civilian potential to kill civilians. I think the use of banned landmines and mining is actually incredibly damaging, not just now, but in the future, because it's just so difficult to remove mines and to safely rebuild. I would be the most afraid of something like Chechnya happening. And that is just an absolute smashing of every facility, every structure, every civilian institution. That level of blunt warfare is, I think, far more, both damaging and also likely compared to, say, chemical or nuclear weapons.
Mm. David asks more broadly about right now with food chain and security, like, are food trucks able to move into Ukraine from NATO, and how is that working?
So yes, I mean, there's a couple interesting points about Ukraine and food that are important. One is food distribution is happening pretty actively with the World Food Program, and organizations like WFP are the largest aid agency in the UN, and they do a lot in logistics, supply chain, food distribution, et cetera. And they're very active now. So I think that those organizations are able to get to areas or many areas that have need. So I think that there is, reasonable access for food distribution in Ukraine. An interesting side note to that is that Ukraine is essentially the breadbasket of the world. And so the disruption of agriculture in Ukraine is going to lead to major food shortages in Africa and throughout Asia and Africa because of the importance of Ukraine as a production of food for aid around the world. So, one problematic impact of this conflict is the disruption of Ukrainian exports into humanitarian environments that are already very short of food.
This question's from Stephen, and I wanted to kind of expand it out. Going back to what you were talking about with this conflict, but also in the context of the needs of other conflicts as well, how would you envision a more coordinated cross-disciplinary response to this conflict and other humanitarian situations? And Stephen in particular asks about Harvard as an example or other universities. And I wanted to expand that out too, to ask about more broadly when we think about when you're talking about the coordination of humanitarian responses and the needs around the world.
So Stephen, I think that was a plant. That's a great question that I wished I would have had somebody ask. Because one of the things that Harvard does, HHI does, is actually assist and work towards mechanisms to better coordinate humanitarian response. So there's a system in the UN and NGO ecosystem called the cluster system, or variations of that. And what that means is that there's a number of mechanisms whereby humanitarian organizations coordinate. One of the problems about that is that not all of those organizations on the ground, working on the ground, are aware of these mechanisms or how to coordinate. So, for example, HHI hosts a USAID-funded educational program called Building a Better Response. Building a Better Response actually has gotten to over 80,000 people who are humanitarian aid workers in the field in multiple languages in order to help them understand the humanitarian architecture and coordinate better. So that's one thing of many things that we do to help encourage and promote humanitarian coordination.
What about more broadly? It sounds like that this becomes a political thing as well when you think about outside of HHI or universities in terms of addressing coordinating more broadly.
Well, and just to be clear, that HHI's efforts are small efforts compared to the geopolitical efforts of coordination. The big efforts are really based in the UN Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. They work with this sort of series of coordinating bodies that work together to try to get, say, members of the health sector that all work in health together, members of food and water together, or water and sanitation together, et cetera. And so there is a large, I guess, system of humanitarian coordination that is in play right now in Ukraine and is in play around the world.
This question is from Deborah, and then I think that we're at a good point to start wrapping up. Is there a consensus among civilized nations that we have a moral imperative to protect vulnerable people, especially children? And beyond the violence of war, doesn't starvation become a really serious concern? And is there a consensus between all countries around this being a higher issue?
Wow. Yeah. So, you know, let's, what I'll do is I'll take on like global UN-based consensus. So the United Nations is a body of individual nations that respect the sovereignty of nations, but also advocate for larger scale norms, I suppose. And those norms are really well spelled out in international humanitarian law and the Geneva Conventions, et cetera. And so there is a universal acceptance of the protection of civilians and the protection particularly of vulnerable civilians like children in the context of war. That's, you know, nearly universal. It's just not respected in times of conflict. And so in this case, and in many that we see, the rules of war, there are a thing called the, you know, international humanitarian law or the law of war. They're not respected. And so it is not the recognition of the norms, but it's actually the implementation or the accountability. And finally, I'll say just to the issue of malnutrition is the greatest plague actually that we have, food insecurity, because war disrupts food delivery, farming, et cetera. And so if you look around the world, there are, you know, in the Horn of Africa, 40 million people in need of food aid, right? There's tens of millions of people in each of those humanitarian crises that I met that are in dire need of food security and food aid. And so that is a major and dominant theme in the humanitarian space.
I want to add in a question here. Marina writes, I'm from Ukraine and have noted tremendous bottlenecks in delivery and distribution of humanitarian supports. What seems to work best are local efforts of Ukrainians on the ground running vans to the front line and supporting internally displaced people. What are we learning from this war about how humanitarian assistance is best provided?
That's a great point and really interesting, because organizations, the dependence on external organizations for support is really mainly for support. But at the end of the day, or actually probably at the beginning of the day, as it were, when an acute crisis happens, we don't necessarily acknowledge it, but it's the local population that really serve the needs of their fellow countrymen. We see this in a large scale natural disasters, when before relief teams show up, the people who really respond are locals, the heroes are local. And in this case, the heroes are, you know, people who are supporting their own community, their own coming up with ways to evacuate and clear people and move them out, and taking elderly people from their apartments and getting them out and things like that. So those efforts, I think we don't hear that much about because we're focused on the international efforts, but they are actually the most heroic efforts, because they are, they're largely more and quickly effective while something is, you know, an active conflict is going on. So that's a great point.
I know you mentioned this at the top about, you know, as people want to support people in crisis right now in Ukraine, there's some kind of myths about or misunderstandings about like donations, you know, and what people need as opposed to cash. And this question from Dana, I just want to get back to that theme, is that for organizations that aren't relief groups, but have staff that want to donate cash and in-kind services, what are the best ways for groups to do that in Ukraine?
So I would say that there is a, you know, just acknowledging there's a tremendous hunger to give more than cash, to either volunteer or to pack things up or materials to pack up. And I understand it, because we all feel that. That being said, the most, aside from a relief organization that has protocols and practices and personnel that really do things professionally, I think links to local organizations to provide cash is almost always the best way.
Now, what is the best way to link to that is, I think, what this question is getting at.
Right. And so there's a couple of ways. One is, I don't know the best organizations to link with in Ukraine and to get direct access. There are ways to do that, but there are also really good international non-government organizations, and I'll just call out International Rescue Committee as well, because they're very good and they're locally on the ground. And then there is a big UN agency, the UN OCHA that I mentioned, has a Ukraine humanitarian fund that is serving those populations as well. So those are actually good ways to sort of get collective donations to those people. And it turns out donations are probably the most effective way to get really material support in the hands of people who need it.
Thank you so much for fielding all these questions and for your time. I just wanted to wrap up with some deeper reflections from you about one of the things you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation is about, you know, what has been happening in other areas of conflict around the world. And I wonder what kind of lessons you've learned from these other areas and regions that now really apply to Ukraine, even though, as you also mentioned, the situations are different in terms of the types of attacks and how it plays out. And in reverse, what do you think now you're learning about the humanitarian response in Ukraine that might be building or bringing greater lessons about humanitarian response elsewhere around the world?
Yeah,
just a small question.
Just that. You're right.
Final reflection.
So I think that, you know, the issue of war itself and it, you know, the disruptive nature of war cannot be overstated. It is, you know, war is the great de-developer. It takes a developed nation like Syria, for example, and just completely decimates it. And so I think the idea of the use of diplomacy, so humanitarian action cannot be a replacement for diplomacy. So diplomacy and engagement is paramount. Another thing that we see in a very economically interconnected world is that there are pressures that we can place to make sure, without necessarily conflict, to make countries comply with some sort of normal standard and maybe even prevent war. We'll also say that there are many, hopefully many things that we can do to look at vulnerable states. We know those vulnerable states, we see them. Mm-hmm. And so the ways that we can contribute to stabilization efforts, mitigation around migration, like, you know, drought control, et cetera. So there's a lot of work to be done preemptively. And those are big kind of policy issues. I think lessons learned from Ukraine in this case is, once again, that aid is a tool to be used to help stabilize a population, but it is not in and of itself the solution. And we see that in areas all around the world. I think one thing that I just want us all to take away is that all sounds trite, I guess, but all people matter. And so our Ukrainian colleagues and our Ukrainian citizens really matter, but Syrians really matter. Yemenis really matter. People suffering in the Horn of Africa really matter too. And so if this can do anything, it would help us all realize that the power and the need for a sustained effort in humanitarian aid around the world is key.
That was Michael Van Royan, director of the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative. This Q&A was jointly presented by the studio at Harvard's Chan School and us here at The World. You can view the video of this conversation at our Facebook page, and you can find that at theworld.org/Facebook, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.